Before we call the next case, I see we have a class with us today, and I would like to welcome all of the children from the class here in the courtroom, and we look forward to having you as our law clerk someday in the not too distant future. We'll call the next case of the day now, which is number 013674, Matto Anderegg against the School District of Whitefish Bay. Suppose we let the courtroom clear, sir, before you begin, okay? Let's let the courtroom clear before we begin. Thank you, Mr. Washburn.
Thank you. Now that the children are gone, I can speak freely. May it please the court, my name is Lou Wasserman. I'm from Milwaukee. I'm here from the Eastern District of Wisconsin to argue this case we have before you. One thing I'd like to make clear at the onset, and I think that I'll make this clear in the couple minutes that I have as to why it's important. I did not represent the plaintiff before the district court, before Judge Covert. I've had this case only on appeal, which meant, unlike all the other cases I've had the opportunity to argue here, I've had to do this one entirely based upon paperwork. And this became a case in October. The notice of appeal was filed, if I remember correctly, about October 9 of last year. And this brief that I filed on behalf of the plaintiff was filed back in February 19th. Now, here we are on the 29th of May. I've had over 3 months to think about what I've submitted to you so far. And I've come to the conclusion, now that I've had as much time after the brief as before to think about the case, that there's a shift in emphasis that I would take if I were to rewrite this brief that I think is critical. And that's what I want to use these couple minutes I have to go over with you, because I think if I can convince you on this simple point, then you'll see why it is that I believe, on behalf of the plaintiff, that Judge Covert did not see this case correctly. In Judge Covert's order dated September 14th of 2001, he notes, as he points out in the initial matter, that the defendant had asked the court to disregard plaintiff's affidavit filed in opposition to summary judgment because of what the defendant was arguing was contradictory testimony. And I, you know, at first I thought about that, and I knew it was an issue, and we dealt with it in the brief, but since I have had this time to think about it, I believe this is a critical issue, and I will explain why. What happened here was this. Judge Covert believed, as the defendants asked him to, that in paragraph 55 of her affidavit, meaning Ms. Matto Anderegg, the plaintiff herein, that she said that several weeks prior to her non-renewal, she had spoken to Gary Schumacher, who hired her, who was the director of personnel, who was the liaison with the board, and had told him several weeks prior to her non-renewal about her complaints with regard to the principal, Neil Codell, who, by the way, since has left Whitefish Bay. Well, in the deposition, apparently, according to the district court, she says something quite different. That's what the district court concluded. And in the deposition testimony, it says that prior to this time, meaning the non-renewal, she didn't speak to anyone in the school administration or on the Whitefish Bay School Board about Codell's actions. Well, I took a look at this now much more carefully, and I see that that's completely inaccurate. That's a complete misrepresentation or misunderstanding of what Ms. Matto Anderegg's testimony was at her deposition and in her affidavit. If we look at the record number is 40. That's the deposition. It's at pages 58 to 61. It's quite clear that in that affidavit, and this is in the record on appeal, that Ms. Matto Anderegg indicates that she had a discussion with Mr. Schumacher. And it's quite clear that she indicates that she had this discussion prior to the time of non-renewal. Now, it's also clear from looking at Mr. Schumacher's deposition, that's also record number 40, his deposition, because it's all attached to the same affidavit, pages 21 to 24. He also states quite clearly that he had a discussion with Ms. Mateau-André, and this is what he said. He's questioned. What she said at the meeting was the same thing that is now in the complaint, referring to the complaint before the district court. He says, I don't recall whether it was the same thing, but the general topics were similar, yes. And this is repeated throughout his deposition. This seems simple because it's only a couple of lines, but here's why it's critical. The non-renewal, in fact, occurs in March. The actual decision by the board is March 11. Prior to that, there's a March 5 letter, there's a March 2 letter, but all of the formal notifications and procedures were conducted in March. But prior, back in January, informally, Neil Codell informed Corel Mateau-André that he was thinking that he might indicate to the board non-renewal of her contract. And it is right after that, and I think the record on this is absolutely quite clear, and it's clear in Mr. Schumacher's deposition that he talked to Mateau-André, Ms. Mateau-André, twice. Once, right after he learned, and he went to her, that Neil Codell was thinking about non-renewal. And that's when they had the conversation that she related. So when in the district court's view, when he said that she changed her response, she didn't, because the non-renewal occurs in March. That's when the formal process occurs, both the notification and the formal process. It's very quick. I mean, the total process, formally, doesn't last more than 2 weeks. So, in fact, Ms. Mateau-André did not contradict herself. Now, why is this critical? It's critical because here's what happened afterwards. And I think it's clear from reading this decision what happened. At this point, to quote a famous personage, Judge Clevert came to a fork in the road and he took it. What he did was this. At this point, when he X's out paragraph 55, he does more than that. He then ignores the fact, because of his deciding not to look at that portion of Ms. Mateau-André's deposition or her affidavit, he then doesn't look at what Mr. Schumacher says when he says, I knew. She told me. What did she tell you? I don't recall exactly, but it's the same thing she put into her complaint. So she did complain to Gary Schumacher about what she thought was prejudicial treatment. And she said, and it's quite clear, that she complained to him because he hired her and he was the board's liaison.
Could I think I have the gist of this point, ask you on the point of who's the decision maker, what the record shows with respect to Principal Codell's input into the board's decision-making process? He's the one who compiles the file, or is it Schumacher? How do we link Codell's alleged discriminatory animus to what the board did?
Well, the link is, this is in the record. At one point during his deposition, he says, we didn't renew her. We took this action.
That's Mr. Codell.
Yes. He clearly sees himself at that point as being the board. The board, in fact, almost acting for him as opposed to being the other way around. And also under the Meritor case and all of its progeny, it really, that's a red herring in a way, because the rule in this circuit is that whether it's the, look, this is not a janitor that came up to her at some point and made a sexually harassing remark. This was, in fact, the board's representatives, both of them, the two highest other than the superintendent, the director of personnel and the principal of the school, one who committed the acts and one who knew about the acts and was the liaison to the board and obviously took no action. But the other critical part of this decision made by Judge Clevert that we believe is an error is because he went down the wrong path, he then decided that this was not a case involving direct acts of discrimination. It had to be inferential.
Well, that's why we have to get to Codell. That's why we need to know what the evidence is that perhaps in this district or somehow structurally the principal repository of responsibility for deciding which teachers to hire, which to renew, which to non-renew lodges where? Lodges with the principals. Obviously, formally, we know the board has to take an action, but the link needs to be there.
Yes. I can briefly explain that. Ms. Matoandereka was actually hired by Gary Schumacher, and that's because at the time it was a part-time hire. And then the previous principal, Mr. Safer, this is all part of the record, had told her prior to Podell coming in that he was going to, in fact, recommend her for the full-time position. And then, in fact, because Safer left and Codell came in, Codell made the recommendation, and then he made the recommendation, if you want to call it that, not to renew. It was his decision completely, both up and down. And there's
the
length
of the
board.
Say that that's his role as the decision-maker is something that one could find support for in this record.
There is no other decision-maker. There's a stamp on that decision.
Okay.
But that's all it is, in my view. Thank you.
Ms. Hagerty.
May it please the court, my name is Maureen Hagerty, and I'm here on behalf of the Whitefish Bay School District, asking this court to affirm the district court's entry of summary judgment. Briefly, with respect to paragraph 55 of the affidavit that Mr. Wasserman addressed this morning, the meeting where this took place between Gary Schumacher and the appellant, this meeting started with Mr. Schumacher approaching the appellant and informing her that it was likely that her contract was not going to be renewed and that he was going to discuss the process of non-renewal with her. At this time, she raised her complaints with Principal Codell. So yes, indeed, this conversation did take place before the actual non-renewal, which was the school board voting to non-renew her contract.
So why isn't that enough to make them consistent enough to be used? We won't allow an affidavit to contradict a prior deposition, but this does seem to be a situation where she begins to see which way the wind is blowing from Principal Codell, maybe as far back as December. Then she has this conversation, but then the final act is taken, which she could have understood as the subject of conversation in the deposition.
I agree, but the tone of the affidavit was that she had no idea she was going to be non-renewed and that she had made complaints to the school district about this prejudicial conduct that she had received from the principal.
The tone is a lot to actually exclude. Does it make any difference to your case? I mean, let me ask you the same question I asked before. This is not a 1983 case. If it were a 1983 case, it would be very easy to say that the school board isn't the same thing as the principal, and there's no respondeat superior liability in 1983 cases. This is a Title VII case where we have supervisors all the time being the people who commit miscellaneous discriminatory acts, and indeed we have a whole branch of how do you deal with it if it's harassment, and then we have regular, if you can call it that, discrimination. I don't see why the 1983 model, which I'm concerned might be the one that the district court had in mind, applies if it's a Title VII case. Here, Principal Codell is certainly the one with the primary input, if not almost the sole input, but surely we would agree the primary input into the board's ultimate formal action.
I would disagree.
Did the board, were members of the board visiting her class?
No, they were not.
Supervising her?
But plaintiff failed to produce any evidence as to what kind of role Principal Codell took in the non-renewal. The fact that
he recommended it, right?
Absolutely, he recommended.
And he said he did some of the evaluations, right?
Yes.
Three of them.
That is
four.
True.
So she did produce some evidence.
Did the board have any information before it other than that submitted by the principal?
No. The appellant was given the opportunity to address the board concerning her non-renewal prior to the vote and chose not to. So the board gave the appellant the opportunity to come to them and say, I disagree with these reasons because Principal Codell is giving me a raw deal because I'm a woman and I am not American-born. She chose not to, and so she left the board with all the only information they had was from Principal Codell.
But if he's the one who's allegedly biased, that's enough for a trier of fact to take into account his bias in the decision. It doesn't matter if everybody in the board had a pure heart and a clear mind. If the only information upon which they based their decision came from the allegedly biased individual.
I would disagree, and I would cite the Kennedy case of this court in support of our position. In that case, a female attorney was terminated for lack of productivity and an economic slowdown that affected the firm. Prior to her termination, her supervising attorney said things such as, if you were my wife, I'd want you home with your kids, or that she should be home with her kids, statements that were similar to what the appellant accuses Principal Codell of making. The court found that those statements made by her supervising attorney were not direct evidence of discrimination because the supervising attorney did not participate in the decision to renew that.
Right, but that's precisely the distinction I'm getting at. It would be impossible to say that Principal Codell didn't participate if he was the generator of the entire file and the recommender of the decision.
Well, there are incidents, or this court has found incidences where a subordinate can be found to be the de facto decision maker, and I think that's what you're getting at here. In the case of Willis versus Marion County, this court addressed a situation like that and found that the plaintiff bears the burden of proof of proving that the subordinate, in this case Principal Codell, was the de facto decision maker.
And of course, you don't actually have to prove things at the summary judgment stage. You have to introduce evidence which, if believed by a trier of fact, would be enough.
Absolutely.
The burden of proof.
Here, the appellant didn't address or didn't introduce evidence into the record. In the Willis case,
why don't you think the things we've just agreed are in the record count as evidence?
Such as
the fact that he's the one who recommended the non-renewal, such as the one that he's the one who prepared the 3 out of the 4 evaluations, such as the one that you just said the whole record, indeed, before the board was the one compiled by him. If that's in the record, and as my recollection is that it is, that I'm certainly ready to stand corrected, but that's evidence. Maybe
but
somebody wouldn't believe it, but it's evidence.
Principal Codell was not on the school board and did not have a vote in whether to non-renew the appellant's contract.
But that's what I'm trying to get at. Why is that? What case says that's required? We have a lot of cases in the 1983 area which are clear that you don't have that form of respondeat superior liability. But Title VII includes agents. In its definition,
it includes agents, but it limits the agents of the employer to agents that are also decision makers.
And why isn't the principal a decision maker for Title VII purposes? Surely, if the principal had been harassing a particular teacher sexually in an inappropriate way, that teacher would have an action against the principal under the standards of Ehlers and Farragher, even though no member of the school board was participating. They might not have even known it was happening. So why is it different? That's just a form of discrimination.
It's different because state statute in Wisconsin says that the decision to non-renew a teacher's contract is vested in the school board, not the principal. And so it's the school board that is the decision maker. In the Willis case, this court set forth factors to consider when a employee, a subordinate, is a de facto decision maker. Those factors included concealing relevant information or otherwise manipulating the decision maker. Here, the appellant introduced no evidence of that. In fact, the appellant did not depose a single member of the school board to inquire about why they made their decision and what they relied upon. Another factor that the court said was to consider, or that the courts are to consider, is that whether the decision maker undertook an independent investigation of the claims. Here, there's no evidence that the appellant made any claims of discrimination, so they had no reason to independently investigate Principal Codell's actions. And the third factor to be considered was whether the appellant was given the opportunity to substantiate her claim, and indeed, here she was. It's undisputed that she requested a special hearing with the school board, and then 2 days before the hearing, she canceled it and just said that she disagrees with Principal Codell's reasons and left the school board to guess as to why she disagreed. So the plaintiff has failed to demonstrate that Principal Codell was the de facto decision maker in this case. As a result, I don't think you can attribute Principal Codell's statements to the school board in this case, and we'd ask that you affirm.
Before you sit down, one question. There is a statement in the record, apparently, that the principal at one point did say that he wanted more men in the department or that there were too many women in the department. When was that statement made?
That statement was made, I believe, in January of 1999, and the decision by the school board to non-renew the appellant was March 10th of 1999, so 2 months.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wasserman, have some time? We'll make that make that 30, sir, if you...
The board seems to be arguing something that isn't part of Title VII, an exhaustion of remedies kind of procedure that isn't required by Title VII. You know, it's very difficult for anyone, much less someone who was in the position of Ms. Mitoandrake, to go and have to retell a story to basically the same people your principal has already indicated really are just going to make the same decision. That's a very, very difficult thing to do. I don't think she should be held against her in any way that she didn't do that. It's not required under Title VII. The discrimination occurred. It's never had its just day, and that's all we're asking for is to be able to have its day in court. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both Mr. Wasserman and Ms. Hegarty for their fine